Technocracy, Inc., a who's who of global control, by Will Stickle. An adult brain audiobook production, read by Barclay Cavill. Introduction. The Age of Invisible Power. Technocracy is often presented as progress, a sign that humanity has matured beyond tribalism, politics, and ideology. But stripped to its core, technocracy means rule by engineers, systems, and experts, where authority flows not from consent but from claimed competence. It is a governance structure where equations, algorithms, and technical expertise are treated as substitutes for collective decision-making, where political leaders gradually surrender control to specialists in the name of efficiency and precision. This shift didn't happen overnight. It evolved alongside industrialization, automation, and the growing belief that society could be managed like a machine, predictable, measurable, and optimized. The roots of technocracy can be traced back to the early 20th century when engineering and systems theory collided with political thought. The Industrial Revolution had already proven that machines could replace human muscle. Now, the same philosophy was applied to human judgment itself. If production lines could be optimized, why not economies? If traffic systems could be modeled, why not entire cities? And if people were just another set of variables in a complex network, why shouldn't they be governed like one? This was the seductive promise. Eliminate the chaos of human politics, reduce uncertainty, and let the best minds run the world. On the surface, this sounds logical, rational even, but logic has owners. Algorithms do not create themselves, and expertise does not exist in a vacuum. Every system reflects the priorities, values, and assumptions of the people who design it. When engineers are elevated to the role of policymakers, their worldview becomes the framework for everyone else's reality. And when those frameworks are encoded into technology, the choices they make are largely invisible to the public. Decisions once debated in the open become buried in code, protocols, and statistical models that no ordinary citizen can challenge. Technocracy thrives on this invisibility. It creates an architecture where control hides behind complexity. When a government claims, "The model shows we must act," it closes the door to debate. When an algorithm determines loan approvals, parole decisions, or vaccine mandates, accountability disappears into mathematical abstractions. Even when predictions fail, when the models are wrong, when the experts are mistaken, there is no recourse. The system adjusts itself, blames faulty data, and continues forward unchallenged. This also shifts the very definition of expertise. Under technocracy, power no longer belongs to those who represent the people, but to those who control information. Scientists, engineers, and data analysts become de facto rulers, not through direct authority, but through shaping the frameworks within which authority operates. Elected officials become figureheads reading from scripts written by specialists, their decisions justified by reports and projections few understand and fewer can refute. The appearance of democracy remains, but its substance quietly dissolves. The most dangerous element is how technocracy manufactures consent. It doesn't rule through brute force, it rules through the illusion of objectivity. When a politician makes a decision, you can question motives and ideology. When a system produces an answer, it's presented as neutral and beyond dispute. The data says becomes a new form of divine authority. People stop arguing about whether a policy is right or wrong and start debating whether they've interpreted the data correctly. This shifts the battleground from ethics to metrics, reducing human values to technical parameters. The deeper consequence is cultural. When society begins to equate intelligence with expertise and expertise with authority, individuality is diminished. People become users, not citizens, inputs rather than participants. Governance becomes less about human flourishing and more about systems management. A citizen's role narrows to compliance within parameters they didn't set and can't meaningfully influence. In such an environment, personal freedom exists only to the extent it doesn't interfere with optimization. Technocracy is also inherently expansionist. Once established in one domain, it naturally seeks others. A system built to regulate energy consumption soon feeds into economic models predicting productivity, which in turn integrate with surveillance networks tracking individual behavior. Each layer justifies the next in the name of efficiency, security, or sustainability. Over time, governance becomes less about leadership and more about administration. Steering a vast machine where no single individual appears to be in control, yet power concentrates silently in the hands of those who build and maintain the machine. The quiet centralization produces a paradox. Technocracy promises decentralization by claiming to distribute decision-making across systems and experts, but in practice it funnels control upward. The more data a system collects, the more decisions are made at the top. The more predictive models influence policy, the less room there is for local context or human judgment. What looks like democratized access to information is often the opposite. It's a narrowing of acceptable narratives enforced by the architecture of technology itself. Technocracy also breeds fragility. Systems optimized for maximum efficiency are highly vulnerable to disruption. When everything is connected, when control flows through a few centralized channels, any failure, technical, economic, or political, cascades rapidly. In such an environment, resilience is sacrificed for precision, and the illusion of control masks the reality of systemic vulnerability. History shows repeatedly that over-engineered systems fail spectacularly. Yet, technocracy doubles down, convinced that better models, better data, and better tools will solve the problems created by its previous designs. But perhaps the most insidious aspect of technocracy is cultural dependency. Over time, populations begin to internalize the belief that ordinary people cannot be trusted to make meaningful decisions. Agency is surrendered voluntarily because people are conditioned to defer to those who know better. Citizens stop expecting transparency, stop questioning authority, and eventually lose the vocabulary to articulate alternatives. Control no longer requires coercion. Compliance becomes self-reinforcing because people genuinely believe there is no other way to manage complex societies. By the mid-20th century, this mindset had already begun shaping the global order. Post-war reconstruction didn't just rebuild cities and economies, it restructured governance itself around managerial expertise. New institutions emerged, financial, political, and scientific, that presented themselves as neutral arbiters of progress. But the foundational logic remained the same. Rule by specialists, centralized control masked as collaboration, and authority justified by metrics and models rather than public consent. The world became a laboratory, and entire populations became experimental variables within it. Technocracy isn't the replacement of politics. It's the perfection of politics under another name. It removes the messy, visible conflicts of ideology and replaces them with quiet, systemic decisions that shape the boundaries of what's politically possible. It hides power where few people can see it and fewer can reach it. And once established, it rarely reverses itself. Because the very systems that enable technocracy are the ones that define its legitimacy. The Industrial Revolution reshaped civilization with a speed and violence unmatched in history. It created vast new wealth, but concentrated that wealth into the hands of small elite, transforming the balance of power across continents. Factories, railways, and mechanized production generated fortunes on a scale unimaginable a century earlier. But this economic transformation also created instability. The explosion of urban populations, the breakdown of traditional social structures, and the rise of a newly empowered working class terrified the ruling elite. What followed was a quiet counter-revolution, the birth of modern ideologies of social control designed to manage populations, channel dissent, and preserve concentrated power under the guise of progress. The first wave of industrial capitalists saw clearly that mass production required mass compliance. Factories didn't function if workers refused to show up, organize, or demand higher wages. The elite response was to engineer systems that could manage labor indirectly without relying on brute force. Education was redesigned not to liberate thought, but to discipline it. Compulsory public schooling, introduced under the promise of literacy and opportunity, became a tool to train obedient workers who could follow instructions and accept hierarchy. The industrial model didn't stop at machines. It extended to people. Human beings became another form of input to be standardized, optimized, and controlled. Simultaneously, new ideologies emerged that reshaped how societies understood freedom, morality, and governance. Utilitarianism, born in the salons of the wealthy, reduced human value to productivity and output, framing the individual as secondary to the greater good. Eugenics followed, cloaked in scientific language, proposing that populations could be improved by managing reproduction and selecting traits deemed desirable by the elite. These ideas were not fringe. They were mainstream among industrial magnates, government planners, and academic institutions. The common thread was always the same, a belief that progress required management and management required control. The working class was not left out of this equation. It became its central focus. As industrial wealth expanded, so did the fear of revolt. Marxism and early socialist movements grew rapidly in response to brutal labor conditions, threatening to destabilize the very system that created industrial wealth. For the elite, the challenge became dual: suppress radical uprisings while co-opting reform movements to maintain legitimacy. Welfare programs, labor laws, and workplace reforms emerged not purely from compassion, but as strategic concessions designed to prevent rebellion while preserving ownership and hierarchy. Social stability was manufactured, not earned. Behind these ideological shifts came the rise of new institutions built to shape thought and behavior. Philanthropic foundations, often funded by industrial fortunes, played a central role. Organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Endowment presented themselves as altruistic forces advancing education, science, and public health. In reality, they were instruments of soft power steering academic research, shaping curricula, and embedding elite values into the very framework of public life. By funding universities, scientific research, and media outlets, they exerted control over which ideas gained legitimacy and which were buried. The narrative of progress was carefully curated, and dissenting voices found themselves marginalized. The Industrial Revolution also transformed government itself. States recognized that sustaining economic growth required predictability, and predictability required managing human behavior on a mass scale. Bureaucracies grew, census systems expanded, and surveillance began to evolve from a military function into a civilian one. Statistical modeling, population studies, and early social sciences became tools to predict and influence trends before they threatened stability. Scientific management, pioneered by thinkers like Frederick Winslow Taylor, turned workplaces into laboratories of efficiency where every movement was measured, every decision optimized, and every deviation eliminated. This fusion of wealth, governance, and ideology laid the groundwork for what followed in the 20th century, an era where the appearance of freedom masked increasingly subtle forms of control. Individuals were conditioned to believe that they were free to choose while the range of acceptable choices narrowed. Public discourse was guided by experts and institutions whose authority came not from democratic mandate, but from their claimed mastery of knowledge. The individual was reframed as a participant in systems they didn't design, while collective identity was reshaped around productivity, conformity, and managed aspiration. By the time the world entered the early 1900s, the foundation was set for the systems of control that dominate modern life. The same industrial fortunes that built factories and railroads also built schools, research institutions, media networks, and public policy frameworks designed to perpetuate their influence. Ideologies of social control weren't imposed through overt tyranny, but through normalization, the gradual integration of centralized authority into the routines of daily life. Control became cultural, embedded in habits, expectations, and institutional trust. People were conditioned to see their role not as sovereign individuals, but as components of an economic engine expected to work, consume, and obey. The wealth generated by the Industrial Revolution didn't just transform economies, it reshaped human psychology and societal structure. It created a managerial class whose power was defined not by birthright but by expertise, a class that believed it had the right, even the obligation, to design society according to its own ideals. From there, the leap to modern technocracy was inevitable. Once control could be justified in the name of efficiency, public health, or stability, the logic extended endlessly. The tools became more sophisticated, the data more precise, and the ideologies more subtle, but the underlying premise remained the same. Power was safest when distributed upward, and populations were safest when guided, monitored, and managed. This was not accidental or inevitable. It was deliberate design. The narrative of progress was written to obscure the transfer of agency from individuals to institutions. Industrial wealth built more than machines, it built systems. Systems that trained generations to equate obedience with stability and dependence with security. What began as an economic transformation evolved into an architecture of control. One that survives today not through overt coercion but through shaping perception itself. Democracy sells the story that power flows upward from the people, that consent forms the foundation of governance, and that leaders serve at the pleasure of those they represent. It promises a system where citizens shape laws, hold authority accountable, and steer the course of their collective future. But beneath this familiar ritual lies a different reality, one where unelected elites wield disproportionate influence, steering policy, shaping narratives, and deciding outcomes, long before the public ever casts a vote. The illusion is sustained through ceremony and spectacle, but the substance of decision-making has been quietly removed from public hands. The appearance of choice is central to this illusion. Citizens are presented with candidates pre-selected by party machines, funded by corporate wealth, lobbied by powerful interests, and filtered through media narratives owned by the same few conglomerates. By the time the public enters the conversation, the boundaries of debate have already been drawn. Elections function less as moments of genuine decision and more as mechanisms of validation, ratifying paths already chosen by entrenched networks of power. Voters believe they're influencing outcomes, yet the machinery of policy, regulatory frameworks, economic strategies, and geopolitical positioning operates largely outside democratic reach. Unelected elites don't announce themselves, they operate through institutions designed to appear neutral. Central banks, intelligence agencies, trade bodies, think tanks, and international organizations. These entities set agendas, draft treaties, and manage crises with little transparency and virtually no direct accountability to the public. Decisions affecting billions, interest rates, financial bailouts, climate policy, military alliances, are made in boardrooms and closed-door summits, not parliaments or town halls. By the time such decisions reach elected officials, they are often framed as necessities rather than options, presented as technical matters beyond the understanding of ordinary citizens. The media amplifies this divide, shaping perception rather than providing clarity. Narratives are curated, debates constrained, and public outrage carefully channeled into safe directions that leave core power structures untouched. The illusion of diversity in opinion masks the reality of a unified consensus among ruling classes on key economic and political priorities. Whether under conservative or progressive branding, the policies that sustain financial monopolies, perpetual debt, and globalized control remain largely unchallenged. Even when governments changed hands, the deeper architecture of governance persists untouched, immune to electoral shifts. This creates a form of managed participation where people are encouraged to engage just enough to validate the system, but never enough to meaningfully disrupt it. Dissent is absorbed into controlled opposition, grassroots movements are co-opted or discredited, and radical alternatives are dismissed as unrealistic or dangerous. The public is conditioned to see complex governance as requiring specialized knowledge, reinforcing dependency on experts and authorities who are neither elected nor easily removed. Power consolidates upward while citizens are pacified with symbols, flags, anthems, campaigns, and slogans designed to maintain emotional loyalty to institutions that no longer serve them. This model thrives on invisibility. The real levers of influence, finance, intelligence, surveillance, technological infrastructure, operate beyond public scrutiny, embedded within bureaucracies that rarely change regardless of electoral outcomes. As the gap between perception and reality widens, trust in democratic systems erodes, but the alternatives are intentionally obscured. People are told that without these systems, chaos would reign, ensuring compliance through fear rather than genuine consent. In this way, democracy becomes less a mechanism of governance and more a performance, a story people are encouraged to believe while the true decisions are made elsewhere. This erosion did not happen suddenly. It evolved alongside industrial capitalism, technocracy, and global integration, with each stage pushing more authority into the hands of those least accountable. Today, as automation, data-driven policy, and centralized finance systems deepen, the distance between voter and ruler has grown to the point where participation often feels symbolic rather than substantive. The paradox is sharp. Citizens are freer than ever to express themselves, yet less able than ever to influence outcomes. Democracy endures as a brand, a reassuring label attached to systems that no longer embody its original promise. The ceremonies continue, the campaigns grow louder, and the narratives more polarized. But behind the noise, the decisions that shape the future remain insulated from public reach. What emerges is not governance by the people, but governance through their consent to stories carefully designed to keep them in their place. The framework of this book rests on a simple directive. Follow the engineers. Follow the money. Follow the code. It's not a slogan, it's a map of power. Everything else, the institutions, the politics, the narratives, flows from these three converging forces. Where engineers design the systems, where money funds and directs them, and where code locks those decisions into permanence, you find the architecture of control shaping the modern world. This is not a conspiracy in the traditional sense. It's a structural evolution. Power moves through infrastructure now, not speeches, not campaigns, but networks, protocols, and algorithms invisible to the public eye. Following the engineers means understanding who builds the machinery of society, both physical and digital. The world runs on systems most people neither see nor comprehend. Energy grids, logistic networks, communication satellites, data centers, and now artificial intelligence models that interpret and act upon reality at speeds humans can't match. Engineers hold more influence than politicians because they design the rules inside which politics operates. A line of code can decide who gets a loan, whose posts are censored, or which supply chains collapse. Governments often implement policies constrained by what engineers deem possible. And yet these technologists are rarely accountable to voters or bound by democratic processes. Their priorities, efficiency, optimization, and scalability, inevitably shape the limits of public freedom. Following the money reveals the motives behind these systems. While engineers build, capital directs. Funding decides which technologies are developed, which remain experimental, and which are buried. Global finance prioritizes control, predictability, and returns on investment. If an innovation threatens entrenched interests or redistributes power downward, it is starved of capital and confined to obscurity. Conversely, technologies that centralize authority, surveillance tools, algorithmic management platforms, predictive analytics, receive nearly unlimited funding because they serve the interests of those who already hold influence. Corporations and financial institutions operate above borders, shaping national policies through lobbying, trade agreements, and debt structures, ensuring that control aligns with profit at every stage. Following the codes exposes how these priorities become permanent. Once decisions are embedded into software, protocols, and digital infrastructure, they are extraordinarily difficult to reverse. Code executes silently, enforcing policies automatically at scale. Algorithms make millions of decisions every second without oversight, interpreting human behavior through data and acting upon it without negotiation. Governance migrates from laws written on paper to rules embedded in systems, where consent becomes irrelevant because participation itself implies compliance. Opting out of these frameworks is nearly impossible. The modern individual relies on platforms and services designed not to be bypassed, where access to information, finance, and even identity depends on technical integration. These three vectors, engineers, money, and code, converge into a new locus of power, one that is distributed enough to seem invisible but coordinated enough to dictate outcomes. Politicians debate symptoms while infrastructure shapes reality. Policy documents are drafted after the systems are already operational, long after the real choices have been made. Voters believe they're electing leaders, but the framework they live within has already been set by the engineers who designed the tools, the financiers who funded them, and the coders who wrote their logic into permanence. The result is a quiet inversion of sovereignty, where the industrial age was defined by control over labor and resources. The digital age is defined by control over information and access. The terrain of power is no longer land or factories, but data, algorithms, and protocols. Whoever sets the parameters sets the boundaries of freedom, and those parameters are rarely debated in public forums. People are conditioned to see innovation as neutral and inevitable, yet every innovation encodes someone's priorities, values, and worldview. The illusion of choice persists while the deeper architecture of decision-making hardens beneath it. This framework is how we dismantle the illusion of randomness and chaos. By tracing the engineers, the financiers, and the code itself, patterns emerge, not abstract theories, but direct causal chains that show who benefits, who loses, and why. It reveals the subtle migration of power away from parliaments, courts, and town halls into systems most people do not control and cannot fully understand. It also exposes the continuity across eras. The same industrial wealth that birthed social control ideologies has now evolved into digital networks where governance is outsourced to algorithms and institutions insulated from public accountability. To understand where we are, we must follow these threads relentlessly. The engineers are not neutral. The money is not benevolent. The code is not passive. Each carries intent, shaping the world silently while the public debates symbols. By studying how these forces intertwine, we reveal the deeper structure behind events that otherwise appear disconnected. Economic crises, censorship battles, resource wars, and policy shifts that seem sudden but are anything but. This is not about predicting the future. It's about decoding the present. The levers of power no longer announce themselves. They operate through technical systems, private networks, and institutional consensus marked as objectivity. By following the engineers, following the money, and following the code, the architecture of control stops being invisible. Once seen clearly, it cannot be unseen. Part 1. Seeds of Control, 1750 to 1920. How the Machine Age Birthed the Technocratic Mindset. Chapter 1. Dawn of the Machine Age, 1750 to 1820. The first industrial revolution marked the opening act of a transformation that would rewrite the relationship between power, production, and society. It began in Britain during the late 18th century and radiated outward, reshaping economies, dismantling traditional livelihoods, and concentrating authority into the hands of those who controlled machines and resources. At its core, this revolution was about energy and control. Energy harnessed through steam and coal, and control achieved through mechanization, patents, and systems that turned human labor into another component of industrial machinery. The rise of the steam engine sits at the heart of this shift. James Watt, often celebrated as an innovator, perfected the design but also secured patents that effectively gave him dominance over an emerging energy economy. Steam power transformed not just industry but society itself, unlocking an unprecedented capacity to move goods, people, and information faster than ever before. Yet Watt's story reveals the deeper undercurrents driving the revolution. Intellectual property laws became weapons, ensuring that control over innovation meant control over markets. Watt's patents didn't merely protect his ideas. They created monopolies that throttled competition and concentrated wealth into fewer hands, setting a precedent for the industrial age. Richard Arkwright extended this transformation by pioneering the factory system. His vision wasn't just about building machines, but designing entire environments optimized for production. By centralizing labor, materials, and technology under one roof, Arkwright created a model where workers became extensions of the machines they served. Individual craftsmanship, once the foundation of economic independence, was dismantled in favor of uniformity and scale. The factory system extracted autonomy from artisans and farmers, pulling them into regimented routines where every movement was dictated by the demands of machinery. This shift fundamentally altered the human relationship to time, labor, and survival, tethering millions to industrial schedules and corporate dependency. Eli Whitney added another layer to this transformation through his development of interchangeable parts. At first, this seemed a democratizing innovation, simplifying manufacturing, reducing costs, and accelerating production. But interchangeable parts carried with them the seeds of early automation. They eliminated the need for highly skilled craftsmen, replacing individual expertise with standardized processes that could be replicated by less trained labor or, eventually, by machines entirely. Whitney's system laid the groundwork for a new philosophy of production. Efficiency above all else, with human variability treated as a flaw to be engineered out of existence. Together, these innovations shattered centuries-old patterns of life. The first industrial revolution didn't simply create new industries. It restructured society around centralized systems of production, ownership, and control. Power flowed not to those who worked, but to those who patented, financed, and scaled technology. The entrepreneurs and financiers of this period understood quickly that mastery of energy, infrastructure, and mechanization meant mastery over markets and populations alike. Steam, coal, and steel became tools of empire, enabling nations like Britain to dominate global trade and impose industrial models across continents. Yet, the most profound impact wasn't just economic, it was psychological. For the first time, vast numbers of people became dependent on systems they neither understood nor controlled. Survival hinged on wages rather than land, and communities that had once sustained themselves through local production found their autonomy stripped away. The promises of industrial progress, wealth, convenience, modernity, came at the cost of independence, identity, and agency. Behind the celebrated ingenuity of Watt, Arkwright, and Whitney lay the birth of a new form of power. Control achieved through technology, protected by law, and scaled by finance. This period was the blueprint for every industrial wave that followed. It established patterns that still define modern life. Monopolies cloaked in innovation, centralized systems shaping human behavior, and an ever-tightening integration between technology and governance. The first industrial revolution didn't just change how people worked. It changed what it meant to be free within a system designed to manage and extract human potential at scale. Company towns emerged in the 19th century as industrial wealth collided with the need to manage growing workforces, producing one of the most effective systems of social control the modern world had seen to that point. On the surface, these towns were marketed as benevolent model communities built by forward-thinking industrialists to provide workers with housing, schools, stores, and entertainment. In reality, they were laboratories of paternalism designed to keep labor disciplined, dependent, and compliant, while ensuring that every aspect of workers' lives, from wages to rent to morality, remained under the company's control. At the heart of the company town was the promise of stability. Industrialists framed their creations as utopian solutions to overcrowded cities and chaotic urban poverty, offering workers a carefully managed environment where their basic needs would be met. But the design was deliberate. Company-owned housing kept workers geographically tethered to the workplace, while company-owned stores captured the wages they paid out. It wasn't uncommon for employees to be paid in scrip, currency valid only at company stores, effectively eliminating their ability to participate in the broader economy. A man could work 60 hours a week and find himself perpetually indebted to the same employer who issued his wages. Debt became a silent tool of control, binding families to corporations as securely as any chain. These towns didn't just regulate the economy of their residents, they shaped their culture, habits, and values. Management often dictated acceptable behavior, policing morality through rules about drinking, gambling, and church attendance. Some towns imposed curfews, others banned labor organizing outright, surveilling workers and punishing dissent. In many cases, the company acted as landlord, judge, employer, and sheriff, collapsing civil society into a single authority. This blurring of corporate and civic power left workers with little recourse when exploitation occurred, as any attempt to challenge conditions meant risking not just a job, but one's home, community, and reputation. Industrialists justified this paternalism by claiming to act in the workers' best interests. Figures like George Pullman, whose rail car company built one of the most infamous company towns in Illinois, argued that controlling employees' living conditions improved productivity and public morality. Pullman's model town boasted manicured lawns, libraries, and neatly planned streets, but workers paid high rents for the privilege of living there and had no ownership of their homes or neighborhoods. When economic downturns forced wage cuts, Pullman refused to lower rents, triggering the 1894 Pullman strike, a violent confrontation that exposed the underlying reality of the system. Beneath the rhetoric of care lay pure economic dominance. The company town also served as a powerful tool against collective action. By isolating workers and entwining every aspect of their existence with their employer, corporations fragmented solidarity and suppressed organizing efforts. Strikes became riskier when losing a job meant immediate eviction and financial ruin. And when workers did resist, companies often called on local or federal forces to maintain order, blurring the lines between private interests and state power. This merging of economic and political authority created a model of corporate sovereignty. Small-scale experiments in governments, where citizens were subjects first and employees second. Despite their decline in the 20th century, the company town established patterns that persist in modern forms. Today's corporate campuses, employer-controlled healthcare systems, and digital platform economies carry echoes of the same logic, intertwining livelihood, community, and identity in ways that erode independence while deepening dependency. Where the Pullmans of the 19th century controlled housing and groceries, today's corporations control data, connectivity, and access to opportunity. The tactics evolved, but the underlying strategy remains unchanged. Concentrate authority, manage behavior, and create environments where opting out feels impossible. The birth of company towns revealed an enduring truth about industrial capitalism. Control was never just about labor performed inside the factory. It extended outward into every facet of life, weaving economic dependence, cultural conformity, and moral discipline into a single framework. These towns were not accidents of history. They were deliberate architectures of power designed to secure profits by managing people as tightly as machinery. The lesson is clear. Whenever an institution claims to provide for every need, it rarely does so without expecting something greater in return, not just labor, but submission. The first industrial revolution laid the groundwork, but it was in the 19th century that the first truly data-driven society began to emerge. For the first time in history, human activity was quantified, measured, and optimized at scale, transforming labor and production into a mathematics of control. Logistics, productivity, and profit became the metrics around which entire societies were reorganized. What began as a response to industrial complexity evolved into a philosophy. Everything that could be measured would be managed, and everything that could be managed could be exploited. Factories became laboratories of precision. Owners and engineers tracked every variable that influenced production. Hours worked, units produced, machine downtime, material costs, and shipping speeds. The worker was no longer viewed as an individual but as a statistical unit, a variable in an equation designed to extract maximum output for minimum cost. Time and motion studies analyzed each gesture, each tool placement, each break between tasks. Frederick Winslow Taylor's scientific management, developed in the late 1800s, epitomized this shift. Break every job into discrete motions, measure each one, and eliminate anything deemed inefficient. Human judgment was no longer trusted. Optimization became a mechanical imperative. This obsession with measurement extended beyond the factory walls into the movement of goods and resources. Railroads became the arteries of industrial society, and their efficiency depended on unprecedented coordination. Companies tracked schedules, distances, tonnage, and costs down to fractions of a cent. Standardized time zones, once irrelevant to daily life, were introduced not for social convenience but for logistical necessity. Coordinating massive flows of coal, textiles, steel, and food required centralized planning supported by meticulous data collection. Information became power, and those who controlled it gained leverage not just over production but over entire economies. Governments followed suit, adopting similar methods to manage growing populations in increasingly urbanized environments. Census taking became more sophisticated, recording not just counts of citizens, but occupations, earnings, literacy, and housing conditions. Bureaucracies expanded to analyze these data sets, translating them into policies that shaped everything from tax systems to military conscription. Industrial wealth depended on a steady, predictable labor force, and measuring people became a prerequisite for controlling them. A society that once moved at the pace of seasons now moved at the pace of schedules, deadlines, and output quotas. The link between data and profit grew inseparable. Companies learned that the more they measured, the more they could extract. Logistics systems evolved to minimize waste and maximize margins, while supply chains stretched across continents to chase lower costs and greater returns. Business records became more detailed and standardized, enabling corporate empires to manage thousands of workers and millions of transactions with unprecedented precision. Efficiency became a moral imperative, and profitability its measure of virtue. What wasn't measured didn't matter, and what couldn't be quantified was treated as irrelevant. Yet this data-driven order also created new hierarchies. Those who gathered, analyzed, and controlled information occupied positions of growing authority, while those being measured were stripped of agency. Decisions were increasingly made by distant managers and financiers who never set foot on the factory floor, but dictated how every second, every shipment, and every resource would be used. The early industrialists realized something profound. Control over data meant control over people, not through direct coercion, but by designing the systems within which their lives unfolded. This period marks the beginning of a deeper cultural shift. The belief that society could be engineered through measurement and feedback loops. Once people accepted that efficiency was synonymous with progress, they also accepted its demands: tighter schedules, greater surveillance, and reduced autonomy in exchange for stability and growth. The first data-driven society didn't simply produce goods faster, it produced new forms of dependency, locking populations into systems where survival depended on compliance with rules they had no part in creating. The logic of this transformation would only accelerate in the decades that followed. The techniques refined in factories and railroads became templates for managing entire nations, corporations, and eventually global economies. By turning human activity into data points, industrial society created the tools for control that would later evolve into the algorithmic governance of the modern era. What began as ledgers and schedules became the foundation of systems that would decide, invisibly and automatically, who thrives and who is left behind. The Luddite rebellions were among the first organized uprisings against the power structures born of industrialization, an early revolt against what we would now call machine elites. Beginning around 1811 in Nottinghamshire, and spreading through the other parts of England, these weren't random riots or ignorant acts of anti-technology hysteria, as later narratives frame them. They were deliberate, targeted, and deeply political responses to a system that was rapidly dismantling centuries-old ways of life. The Luddites understood, perhaps more clearly than anyone else at the time, that the Industrial Revolution was not simply about technological progress. It was about control. The rebellion was driven by textile workers, skilled artisans whose livelihoods were being erased by mechanized looms and automated processes. For generations, these craftsmen had operated within a system where mastery of a trade meant independence, dignity, and the ability to negotiate directly for the value of their labor. But with the rise of machines, like those deployed by innovators such as Richard Arkwright and his imitators, the bargaining power of individuals collapsed. Owners could hire unskilled workers, often women and children, to operate machines at a fraction of the cost, replacing artisans entirely. The machine wasn't just a tool, it became an economic weapon wielded by elites to centralize profits and control labor. What the Luddites rebelled against was not the existence of technology, but its deliberate use as a mechanism of displacement and domination. Factories weren't simply introducing efficiency, they were reshaping society into a hierarchy where decisions about work, wages, and survival were made far from the communities they affected. This was understood by the rebels, who targeted machines strategically, smashing the frames and looms and workshops and factories that had displaced their trades. Their actions were coordinated and disciplined, governed by clandestine groups sworn to secrecy under the name General Ludd, an almost mythical leader invoked to unify resistance and confuse authorities. The British state's response revealed exactly whose interests were being defended. Parliament passed harsh laws criminalizing machine breaking, punishable by imprisonment, transportation, or even death. Thousands of troops were deployed, more soldiers than Britain stationed against Napoleon at the same time, to suppress what the government portrayed as an existential threat to progress. The elite narrative reframed the Luddites as backward, irrational, and dangerous, embedding a caricature of them into cultural memory as anti-technology fanatics. This distortion persists even today, where Luddite is synonymous with ignorance rather than resistance. In reality, the Luddites were some of the first to grasp how industrialization concentrated power. They understood that machines were not neutral objects but embodied the intentions of their owners. Control over technology meant control over labor, and control over labor meant control over society. By mechanizing production and erasing autonomy, the elites of the era forced people into dependency on wages while extracting greater profits with fewer obligations to their workforce. The Luddites saw where this led and acted before the transformation was complete. Their defeat was decisive and brutal. By 1816, the rebellion had been crushed through mass arrests, executions, and propaganda campaigns that painted resistance as futile. The factory system expanded without constraint, and with it came the very conditions the Luddites feared. Workers reduced to interchangeable parts, entire communities dependent on centralized employers, and the steady erosion of local self-sufficiency. Yet their warning echoes louder today than it did two centuries ago. Seen through the modern lens, the Luddite rebellions were not a rejection of progress, but a fight over who controls it. They were the first collective stand against a new ruling class, one that derived its authority not from land or bloodlines, but from its command over technology and capital. It was an uprising against early technocrats and financiers who, shielded by the state, reshaped economies without consent and dismantled entire ways of life in the name of efficiency and profit. The tragedy of the Luddites is not just their defeat, but their erasure from the narrative of industrial history. Their struggle was buried under the myth that technological advancement is inevitable and apolitical, a narrative designed to keep populations compliant as new systems of control emerge. But if we strip away the propaganda, their fight marks the opening chapter in a conflict that continues today. Who governs? The people themselves or the owners of the machines they depend on to live? Chapter 2. The Height of the Industrial Revolution. The railroad, steel, coal trinity formed the backbone of the 19th century industrial order, reshaping nations, accelerating empire building, and rewriting the balance of global power. This wasn't just technological progress, it was the creation of a system where infrastructure became synonymous with control. Whoever commanded rail lines controlled trade, whoever controlled steel controlled industry, whoever owned coal controlled energy itself. Together, these forces created the foundations of modern geopolitics, building entire economies to the demands of extraction, production, and movement on an unprecedented scale. Coal was the starting point, the black fuel that powered everything. It drove steam engines, fired furnaces, and lit cities, turning geological deposits into empires. The hunger for coal reshaped landscapes and societies alike. Entire towns sprang up around mines, producing communities entirely dependent on extraction for survival. As demand grew, so did the consolidation of ownership, with a handful of industrialists controlling vast reserves and dictating prices across entire regions. Control over coal wasn't just economic. It meant dominance over energy flows, making it the first true lever of industrial power. Without coal, steel could not be forged, and without steel, railroads could not be built. Steel transformed coal's potential into infrastructure. The Bessemer process, developed in the 1850s, revolutionized steel production, reducing costs and scaling output to levels previously unimaginable. This innovation fed directly into industrial expansion, enabling bridges, factories, ships, and most critically, railroads. Steel magnates like Andrew Carnegie recognized that dominance in this sector meant leverage over entire economies. Those who controlled steel determined the pace and direction of modernization itself. More than a commodity, steel became a political force, shaping both domestic policies and international relations. Nations without steel industries were relegated to dependency, while those with robust production became global players. Railroads tied it all together, transforming steel and coal into instruments of empire. They connected remote mines to urban centers, linked industrial hubs to ports, and bound emerging markets to centralized power. Rail networks didn't just move goods, they reorganized society. Regions that had once been self-sufficient were drawn into industrial economies, their agriculture and resource outputs redirected toward urban factories and global trade. By controlling the railways, industrialists and governments could dictate where cities flourished, where populations migrated, and which territories rose or fell in strategic importance. The power of this trinity became most visible in geopolitics. Industrial nations competed fiercely for access to coal reserves and strategic rail corridors, sparking conflicts that redrew borders and reshaped alliances. In the United States, the railroad barons amassed fortunes and influence rivaling governments themselves, wielding monopolistic control over transport and trade. In Britain, rail networks extended imperial reach, enabling extraction from colonies at scale. Across Europe, industrial competition fueled militarization, as steel-fed armies and coal-powered navies became measures of national strength. Infrastructure wasn't neutral. It was weaponized, forming the skeleton of economic and political dominance. But the integration of rail, steel, and coal also produced a new hierarchy of power at home. Industrial tycoons leveraged their control over infrastructure to dictate labor conditions, manipulate markets, and pressure governments into favorable policies. Towns, industries, and entire populations became dependent on a few corporate empires whose interests increasingly diverged from those of the people they ruled over. In many regions, the state itself bent to the priorities of industrial capital, blurring the lines between public authority and private power. The railroad-steel-coal nexus shaped more than economies, it reshaped time itself. Journeys that once took weeks became possible in days, collapsing distance and accelerating the tempo of commerce, communication, and war. But this speed came with dependence. As societies reorganized around centralized infrastructure, autonomy dwindled. Communities could no longer control their own outputs or set their own rhythms. Survival became tethered to systems they neither designed nor governed. This trinity also set the stage for future industrial transformations. By creating the first truly interconnected economic networks, it provided the blueprint for globalization. Resource extraction feeding centralized production, feeding distribution systems designed to maximize efficiency and profits. It created both the conditions for technological acceleration and the vulnerabilities of systemic interdependence. Empires rose on these rails and furnaces, but they also became hostage to them, reliant on continuous growth to sustain the infrastructure that defined their power. The railroad steel-coal system didn't just fuel the industrial age, it created its logic. It taught elites that dominance depended on control over flows of energy, materials, and people, and that building the frameworks of movement meant owning the future. Every empire that followed, from the colonial networks of Britain to the corporate superstructures of the United States, built on this foundation. The tools evolved, but the principle remained. Infrastructure determines sovereignty, and whoever commands the arteries commands the body. Isambard's Kingdom Brunel embodied the ambition, audacity, and contradictions of the 19th century industrial elite. A visionary engineer, he became one of the central figures in Britain's transformation into an empire defined by steel, steam, and speed. His work on railways, bridges, tunnels, and ports didn't just modernize transportation. It restructured landscapes, reorganized cities, and reshaped the patterns of human life itself. Brunel wasn't simply building infrastructure. He was designing systems of control disguised as progress, creating the frameworks within which society would operate for generations. Brunel's most enduring legacy lies in his work on railways, where he transformed Britain's economic and geographic realities. As chief engineer of the Great Western Railway, he envisioned a seamless network connecting London to the industrial West and beyond, reducing vast distances to manageable spans and making speed the new measure of power. He introduced broad gauge track, a technical innovation that allowed for smoother rides and faster travel, but also served a strategic purpose. By creating a non-standard gauge, Brunel locked up competing railways out of his network, centralizing control under the Great Western and ensuring a near monopoly on critical routes. Behind every celebrated achievement in engineering lay a calculated move to control flows of people, goods, and capital. The bridges and tunnels Brunel built were feats of audacity that symbolized this power. The Clifton Suspension Bridge, the Thames Tunnel, and his massive iron steamships all reflected an industrial mindset that treated nature as an obstacle to be conquered and bent to human will. These structures didn't just connect cities and regions, they integrated economies and bound populations into centralized systems. The Great Western routes dictated where industries could thrive, where towns would rise, and where labor would migrate. Infrastructure wasn't neutral, it determined destiny. Those who commanded it shaped entire social and economic hierarchies, and Brunel understood this better than anyone. Brunel also represented a new kind of authority, the technocratic planner whose influence extended beyond construction into urban design and economic policy. By determining the placement of stations, ports, and transport hubs, he effectively dictated the rhythm of urban life and commerce. Cities reorganized themselves around the demands of his networks, adapting marketplaces, residential zones, and industrial hubs to align with the flows his railways created. Municipal governments deferred to his expertise, and financial backers trusted his vision to maximize returns on their investments. In this way, Brunel stood at the intersection of engineering, finance, and governance. A technocrat before the term existed, shaping cities not through political debate but through the hard realities of steel and stone. His grand projects also revealed a growing entanglement between technology and empire. Brunel's designs enabled Britain to project power across its colonies by accelerating the movement of troops, goods, and resources. Steamships like the SS Great Eastern, among the largest vessels of its time, extended Britain's reach across oceans, reinforcing global trade dominance. Rail networks strengthened internal cohesion at home while linking ports to extractive industries abroad, integrating Britain into an early prototype of globalized logistics. Where military conquest had once been slow and resource-intensive, Brunel's systems offered speed, scalability, and efficiency, making empire cheaper to maintain and harder to resist. But embedded in Brunel's brilliance was the central paradox of industrial modernity. These systems empowered nations while disempowering individuals. Railways standardized time, collapsing local rhythms into schedules dictated by centralized timetables. Towns dependent on his routes prospered, while those bypassed withered into irrelevance. By tying survival to integration within his infrastructure, Brunel inadvertently demonstrated how technological networks could override local autonomy and impose a new hierarchy of access and opportunity. Freedom of movement became less about choice and more about compliance with the systems someone else designed. Brunel's career also illustrates the rise of engineering as a political force. His authority rested not on election or legal mandate, but on mastery of technical knowledge and the ability to manifest visions that few others could comprehend, let alone challenge. He answered primarily to financiers and industrialists who saw infrastructure as both profit and leverage, bypassing traditional democratic structures entirely. This fusion of expertise, capital, and centralized planning was the early template for technocracy, a new ruling class emerging not from aristocratic bloodlines but from control over systems so complex that most of society simply trusted the experts to manage them. Brunel's world was one of ambition and relentless expansion, but its consequences extended far beyond his lifetime. His railways, bridges, and ports didn't just move goods and people. They redefined the relationship between state, market, and individual. They foreshadowed the rise of modern urban planning, where entire populations are organized according to logistical imperatives rather than human needs. In celebrating his genius, Britain also celebrated a quiet surrender, the handover of collective sovereignty to a small class of engineers, financiers, and industrialists, whose decisions shaped the structure of society without requiring its consent. Brunel's legacy isn't just technological, it's structural. His work illuminates how infrastructure became an instrument of governance, where the placement of a railway line could determine the prosperity of a city, and the specifications of a bridge could influence the flow of empire. By following his tracks, we see the emergence of a new paradigm. Power shifting from kings and parliaments to those who control the frameworks through which life is organized. The technocratic age didn't begin in laboratories or data centers. It began on the rails, under the bridges, and in the stations Brunel built. Cornelius Vanderbilt and Andrew Carnegie stood at the principle of the 19th century transformation. Two men whose fortunes reshaped the meaning of power in America and laid the groundwork for a new age of corporate sovereignty. They didn't simply build businesses, they built private empires. Their railroads, steel mills, and shipping lines became instruments of authority rivaling the federal government itself, creating corporate fiefdoms where entire regions, industries, and populations lived under their influence. In their world, wealth wasn't just a measure of success, it was leverage, the capacity to dictate the terms of modern life. Vanderbilt began his rise on the water. Starting with a single ferry boat, he expanded into steamships at a time when control over trade routes meant control over economic opportunity. But it was the railroads where his influence became imperial. By consolidating fragmented lines into a seamless network, Vanderbilt transformed the northeastern United States into his domain. His New York Central Railroad didn't just move goods and people, it decided which towns thrived and which withered. By controlling access to markets, Vanderbilt shaped his geography of wealth, bending entire regions to the needs of his empire. Political leaders deferred to him, financiers courted him, and competitors feared him. Where the state built roads to connect citizens, Vanderbilt built rails to concentrate power. Andrew Carnegie approached empire differently, but no less decisively. Where Vanderbilt dominated transport, Carnegie dominated steel, the material upon which industrial society was built. Through relentless innovation and ruthless cost-cutting, he scaled production to unprecedented levels, flooding markets and undercutting rivals until he controlled the backbone of American infrastructure. Carnegie's steel built the rails Vanderbilt relied on, the bridges spanning America's rivers and the skyscrapers rising in its cities. In an age defined by expansion, Carnegie controlled the substance that made expansion possible. By the 1890s, his operations produced more steel than entire nations, giving him influence over industries, labor markets, and political agendas alike. These men built more than businesses. They created corporate fiefdoms where economic power translated into social dominance. Vanderbilt's control over shipping rates determined the success or failure of entire industries dependent on his tracks. Carnegie's command of steel prices shaped construction, manufacturing, and transportation simultaneously. Their fortunes insulated them from accountability, while their philanthropy crafted narratives of benevolence that softened public resistance. Foundations, libraries, and universities bore their names, but these were not acts of charity detached from strategy. By embedding their influence into education and culture, they secured a legacy that outlived their companies, ensuring future generations would continue to operate within systems they designed. Their methods were often brutal. Vanderbilt cornered markets, crushed competitors, and manipulated stock prices with precision. Carnegie drove workers to their limits while keeping wages low, relying on managers like Henry Clay Frick to suppress strikes and break unions with force when necessary. The Homestead Strike of 1892, where armed guards opened fire on protesting steelworkers, revealed the raw violence underpinning Carnegie's empire. Corporate authority extended beyond the workplace into law enforcement, with private militias and hired detectives acting as enforcers of industrial discipline. When governments did intervene, it was usually to protect property, not people, reinforcing the fusion of private wealth and public power. These corporate fiefdoms revealed the structural shift underway in America. Political democracy continued on the surface, elections, legislatures, and courts. But economic sovereignty migrated upward into private hands. The scale of Vanderbilt and Carnegie's operations allowed them to bypass traditional constraints, negotiating directly with states and leveraging their monopolies to influence policy. Where landowners once ruled through titles and armies, industrialists now ruled through infrastructure and capital. They built systems so large and indispensable that governments themselves became dependent on them. A quiet inversion of authority that laid the foundation for technocratic governance in the decades ahead. What set Vanderbilt and Carnegie apart from their peers was not just the size of their fortunes, but the systems they left behind. Vanderbilt's rail networks became the veins through which the country's economic lifeblood flowed, eventually merging into the broader logistics architecture of the modern age. Carnegie's steel empire evolved into U.S. Steel, the first billion-dollar corporation, institutionalizing corporate dominance at a scale unimaginable a generation earlier. These weren't personal empires anymore. They became permanent structures codified in law, finance, and infrastructure, shaping the trajectory of the nation long after their founders' deaths. By the early 20th century, Vanderbilt and Carnegie had helped create a reality where economic power and political sovereignty diverged. Their corporate fiefdoms operated like parallel states, with their own rules, enforcement mechanisms, and spheres of influence. Workers, communities, and even governments were subordinated to industrial priorities, often without realizing it. The wealth they amassed didn't just buy influence, it rewrote the framework within which society operated, leaving behind systems designed to favor the consolidation of power and the minimization of resistance. Their legacies illuminated a larger truth about the industrial era. The story wasn't just about invention and progress, but about who gained control over the structures those inventions created. Vanderbilt and Carnegie didn't merely ride the wave of industrialization, they directed it, leveraging infrastructure, finance, and labor into a new kind of sovereignty. Their world foreshadowed ours, where corporations don't just participate in economies, they define them, governing without ever appearing to rule. The telegraph marked the beginning of a new kind of empire, not built on land, steel, or coal, but on information. Before its arrival, communication moved at speed of horses, ships, and printed letters. Distance shaped power. Geography dictated strategy. But with the first successful telegraph lines in the 1830s and Samuel Morse's code standardizing the language of transmission, time itself collapsed. Messages that once took weeks to arrive can now travel hundreds of miles in minutes. This shift didn't just connect economies and governments, it transformed the architecture of control, birthing the first networks where information could be centralized, managed, and weaponized. The telegraph rewrote the tempo of commerce. For traders and financiers, real-time update on prices, shipments, and markets meant profits could be extracted at a scale never before possible. Stock exchanges transformed overnight as data began to flow faster than goods themselves, decoupling finance from geography. Investors in London could manipulate the commodity prices in New York or Calcutta based on instant transmissions, widening the gap between those who controlled information and those dependent on it. Economic power began migrating upward, concentrating in hubs where telegraph lines converged, giving financial elites a vantage point above entire markets. Governments understood immediately what the telegraph made possible and what it threatened. Control of information became synonymous with control of the state. Britain, with its global empire, raced to build undersea cables linking its colonies, ensuring London could coordinate military, trade, and administrative decisions with unprecedented speed. Wars were fought and treaties negotiated based on messages relayed through thin copper threads. The ability to move information faster than armies could march or ships could sail gave those who controlled the lines a strategic advantage so profound it reshaped geopolitics. Territories no longer mattered simply for resources. They mattered for their position in the network. But the telegraph didn't just connect it, it concentrated. The infrastructure required massive investment, placing ownership largely in the hands of corporations with state backing. Companies like Western Union in the United States and the Eastern Telegraph Company in Britain created monopolies over the flow of information, deciding who gained access at what cost and on what terms. These were not neutral carriers. By controlling infrastructure, they shaped perception, directing which messages moved, which markets thrived, and which voices disappeared into silence. A new kind of power emerged, the authority not to own territory but to govern information itself. This transformation also redefined warfare. Armies began relying on telegraph lines for coordination, enabling larger and more complex operations across vast distances. But reliance created vulnerability. Cutting cables became a tactic of sabotage, while securing telegraph stations became a strategic priority. Whoever could intercept or manipulate transmissions gained leverage over enemies and allies alike. The telegraph made speed decisive, but also introduced an unprecedented fragility. Networks could be weaponized, and the first contests over information dominance were born. Beyond politics and finance, the telegraph reshaped human perception. It standardized time, collapsing distances into near simultaneity. News no longer belonged to local communities. It became centralized, disseminated through the wire services that decided what stories mattered and in what order they reached the public. Information became less about truth and more about distribution, giving early media gatekeepers disproportionate influence over collective understanding. The capacity to shape narratives at scale emerged alongside the technology that delivered them. The telegraph foreshadowed the systems of information control that define the modern age. It introduced the logic of networks. Whoever owns the infrastructure controls the flow, and whoever controls the flow shapes reality. It created dependencies, embedding economic survival, military strategy, and social cohesion within systems managed by a small number of actors. It demonstrated, for the first time, how power could be exercised invisibly, not through armies or legislation, but by determining what information moves, how fast, and to whom. By the late 19th century, the telegraph had become the nervous system of empire, stitching together distant economies and political centers into a single web. But this integration came at a price. Autonomy diminished as regions fell into synchronization with global financial and political priorities dictated from the top. Local knowledge became secondary to centralized data, and decision-making moved further away from the communities it affected. The telegraph promised connection and delivered control, an early prototype of the algorithmic governance to come. The rise of the industrial working class reshaped the foundations of society in the 19th century, creating vast populations dependent on centralized systems of production and capital for their survival. As factories multiplied and rural populations migrated to cities, entire communities were uprooted from traditional forms of self-sufficiency and thrust into tightly managed industrial economies. This dependency was not an accident. It was the inevitable outcome of a system designed to concentrate resources, control labor, and maximize profit. But dependency breeds volatility, and volatility threatens power. To contain unrest and stabilize this new industrial order, the ruling elite began constructing a framework of social engineering. Tools, institutions, and ideologies aimed at shaping human behavior, conditioning compliance, and manufacturing consent. Before industrialization, most people lived within localized economies where survival depended on access to land, craft, or community. Autonomy came from knowing how to sustain oneself and one's family without reliance on distant systems. The factory system dismantled this balance almost overnight. As mechanized production scaled, independent artisans were replaced by wage laborers, and agricultural families abandoned their land to chase jobs in urban centers. Once severed from self-sufficiency, these new industrial workers were locked into an economic structure where food, housing, and security depended entirely on access to wages controlled by employers. For the first time in history, millions of people had no alternative but to sell their labor to survive. This dependency made the working class both indispensable and dangerous. Industrial growth required a steady supply of compliant labor, yet the very conditions of that labor, long hours, meager wages, unsafe environments, and job insecurity, created fertile ground for dissent. Strikes, riots, and organizing efforts erupted across Europe and America, threatening not only profits but also the stability of entire governments. The elite quickly realized that sheer force could suppress uprisings temporarily but could not solve the structural problem. An industrial economy concentrated masses of workers in the same spaces, under the same pressures, giving them both the grievances and the numbers to resist. If control was to be maintained, it would have to move beyond factories and into the hands of workers themselves. Social engineering became the quiet solution. Education was redesigned, particularly for the children of the working class, not to cultivate critical thought but to instill discipline, punctuality, and obedience, traits valued by industrial employers. Schools mirrored factory routines, fixed schedules, standardized curricula, and hierarchical authority structures conditioned students for life on the production line. Lessons emphasized loyalty to the state and trust in institutional authority, discouraging independent thinking that might challenge existing power dynamics. Literacy was taught not to empower but to integrate. Reading became a tool to consummate state-approved narratives and corporate messaging rather than question them. At the same time, governments and industrialists invested heavily in shaping cultural norms. Propaganda campaigns reframed dependence on wages and centralized production as progress, casting industrial labor as a moral duty and a patriotic contribution to national strength. Religious institutions were co-opted to preach humility, hard work, and submission to authority, blending spiritual identity with economic compliance. Leisure activities were increasingly designed and controlled by employers, from company-sponsored festivals to sporting events, providing carefully curated outlets for frustration, while reinforcing communal loyalty to corporations rather than solidarity among workers. Philanthropy, too, became a weapon. Industrialists like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller funded libraries, universities, and foundations that position themselves as benefactors of the working class. In reality, these institutions acted as tools for shaping acceptable behavior and embedding elite values into society. By controlling the frameworks through which knowledge and opportunity were distributed, the ruling class reinforced narratives that equated upward mobility with personal morality, placing blame for poverty on individual failure rather than systemic exploitation. At the heart of this social engineering was a deeper objective: to neutralize collective resistance by fragmenting the working class and embedding trust in the very systems that exploited it. Labor unions were often undermined through infiltration or outright criminalization, while immigration policies were manipulated to pit ethnic and cultural groups against one another, diverting anger from the elites and toward fellow workers. Surveillance expanded both overt and covert, with factory managers monitoring behavior inside workplaces and police tracking organizing efforts beyond them. Resistance wasn't simply discouraged. It was predicted, contained, and redirected before it could gain momentum. By the late 19th century, industrial society had constructed an architecture of control that reached far beyond economics. Dependency on wages created leverage, education and culture molded behavior, philanthropy and propaganda manufactured trust, and law enforcement provided the teeth when persuasion failed. The population had been reorganized into a system where survival required compliance and where questioning that system became increasingly difficult. The shift from self-sufficient individuals to managed populations marked a turning point in human history, setting the stage for modern technocratic governance where behavior could be shaped not by force but by design. This was the quiet bargain of industrial modernity: stability in exchange for autonomy, order in exchange for agency. The working class gained access to new forms of prosperity, but at the cost of control over the structures shaping their lives. Dependency became normalized, embedded so deeply into the rhythms of daily existence that it ceased to be recognized as dependency at all. And beneath it all, social engineering refined itself into an invisible art, a set of systems and institutions calibrated to maintain equilibrium while ensuring power continued to flow upward. The 1851 Great Exhibition in London was more than a celebration of innovation. It was a declaration of dominance. Organized under the patronage of Prince Albert and housed within the vast glass and iron crystal palace, the event symbolized the self-confidence of an elite class convinced it had mastered not only industry but the future itself. The exhibition displayed 100,000 objects from across the world, representing what Britain framed as humanity's march toward progress, but beneath the pageantry lay something else entirely: a carefully curated showcase of mechanized power designed to cement hierarchy and announce Britain's supremacy in an industrial world it intended to rule. For the British elite, the Great Exhibition was political theater. Britain stood at the apex of global power, its empire sprawling across continents, fueled by coal, steam, and steel. The Crystal Palace became the altar of industrial modernity, where visitors were invited to witness the miracles of mechanization: precision looms weaving textiles at unmatched speed, steam engines driving pistons with relentless force, and intricate tools producing standardized goods that would dominate global markets. Yet this wasn't simply a celebration of creativity. It was a demonstration of control. By flaunting technological dominance, Britain reinforced its authority not only over its own working class, but over colonies, competitors, and potential challengers. The displays reflected a clear hierarchy. British inventions and industries occupied the central exhibits, presented as the pinnacle of human achievement, while colonial contributions were pushed to the periphery, framed less as innovations and more as raw materials, resources to be extracted and refined by British industry. Cotton from India, timber from Canada, tea from Ceylon, and gold from Australia were positioned as trophies of empire, reminders that the wealth driving Britain's mechanized ascendancy came from global exploitation. Colonized people were simultaneously erased and displayed, stripped of agency while their lands and labor were recast as evidence of imperial benevolence. Equally significant was how the exhibition communicated with Britain's own population. For the industrial working class, whose lives were dominated by the grueling schedules of factories and the dependence on wages, the event became a spectacle designed to inspire awe and compliance. The machinery on display was not just impressive, it was overwhelming, presented as inevitable. Progress was framed as a natural, unstoppable force beyond politics or debate. In this narrative, industrialization wasn't a choice but a destiny, and the only rational role for the masses was to accept their place within it. By overwhelming visitors with scale and complexity, the elite created a subtle form of psychological conditioning. If you cannot comprehend the machinery, how could you ever hope to control it? At the same time, the exhibition served as a hub of elite networking and coordination. Industrialists, financiers, scientists, and state officials from across Europe and America gathered under the same roof, forging alliances and sharing strategies for consolidating influence. Deals were struck behind closed doors while the public wandered the galleries, unaware that the real power of the event lay in the relationships being built between governments and corporations. It was an early template for the technocratic summits of the future, gatherings where the public spectacle serves as a distraction while policy and infrastructure are quietly aligned at the top. The Crystal Palace itself embodied this ideology, a vast cathedral of glass and steel. It stood as both an architectural triumph and a symbolic gesture. Transparency for the public, but control for those who built it. Its design reflected industrial Britain's core values: standardization, modularity, scalability, principles that would come to define not only manufacturing, but governance itself. The building, like the machines inside it, represented the capacity to bend nature and society to the demands of centralized systems. Its sheer scale announced Britain's mastery over material, labor, and knowledge, projecting an image of inevitability that made resistance seem futile. But behind the celebration, cracks were already forming. While the exhibition promised a unified vision of progress, the realities outside its walls told a different story. The same mechanization displayed as marvels of modernity had displaced artisans and fueled unrest among the working class. Child labor powered many of the industries being glorified, and colonial extraction left entire regions impoverished while Britain amassed unprecedented wealth. These contradictions were not hidden by accident. They were deliberately obscured beneath spectacle. By dazzling the public with inventions and narratives of benevolence, the exhibition transformed structural inequality into a celebration of British identity and destiny. The Great Exhibition also marked the beginning of a new kind of soft power, the global staging of technological dominance to establish political leverage. Nations left the event not just inspired, but pressured, fully aware that competing with Britain required matching its industrial capacity. It triggered an acceleration of mechanization elsewhere, driving rivals like France, Germany, and the United States to expand their own steelworks, rail systems, and manufacturing empires. But Britain had set the tone. The future would belong to those who controlled machines, energy, and infrastructure, and the rest of the world would either adapt or fall behind. In retrospect, the 1851 Great Exhibition wasn't merely a world's fair. It was the opening ceremony of a new era. It celebrated technological achievement while masking the dependencies and exploitations underpinning it. It dazzled the public while facilitating elite coordination. It framed industrialization not as a contested process, but as a natural law, discouraging resistance and shaping cultural expectations around progress. The Crystal Palace became both monument and message. The machine had arrived, and those who controlled it would shape the world's destiny. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support. and bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.